Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast, Episode 7. I am Nate Mavis, and with me in Pittsburgh is Andrew Brokus.
To be clear, I'm in Pittsburgh. You are not.
I'm in Boston. How are you?
I'm doing well. As we were just saying, it's, I think, lovely weather in both of our respective cities after a week plus of rain and hurricane for you anyway, Nate.
Yes, it's so much nicer this time around. Probably the best podcasting weather I've had so far. So the gods are smiling on episode 7 of the podcast. Yeah.
It's going to be a good episode.
We have Matt Parvis today.
I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, me too.
I think this is a cool thing. I mean, as much as people have talked about the letter files, everything has always been, you know, about what did letterers say. And I guess there's been some criticism of how Matt conducted things. And you know, hopefully we'll get a chance to ask him for his side of things. But I mean, I think the opportunity to hear about things from Matt's perspective is really cool. So I hope people will listen to and enjoy this, because I think it's a cool perspective to get on really the major news item of the last couple of years of poker.
Yeah, if podcasting has taught me one thing, it's that interviewing is hard, and to be able to talk to Matt about it was a treat and very instructive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that he did a perfect job in the letter interview, and he's been pretty candid in talking about things that he regretted doing as well. But I will say, having done some even like friendly interviews, I mean, we're not doing anything dealing with someone, or not that letter was exactly hostile, but you know, Parvis had a little more of an agenda where he was trying to get Howard to say things that Howard maybe was trying not to say. I mean, we've never really even had to deal with that. And even so, it's a lot more of a challenge than I realized to make an interview interesting. So I think people are probably not giving Matt as much credit as he deserves for what's really a pretty difficult job, much, much harder than it looks.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a pretty vocal critic of a lot of poker media, and that includes a lot of outlets. And I was impressed with a lot of things that Matt did. And I think it's almost more valuable if you're a big critic of poker media to hear from the people who are making it.
Yeah, you rarely get a chance to hear their side of things. And there's a lot of stuff that Poker News gets criticized for, and some of it rightfully. But I think it's interesting to hear the actual explanations for why things are done the way they are. Because, I mean, sometimes people make assumptions about the way things happen, which aren't necessarily the case. I think it's pretty interesting to hear from someone as smart and articulate as Matt is, who can really explain the way things are done and why.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's timely too, because Full Tilt is back up as of like 7 a.m.
Right.
This morning, something like that. Have you checked? I mean, we're in the States, we can't play, but did that all go off?
I've just seen the discussion. Actually, I saw a funny series of tweets. I wish I remembered who these came from. Someone had said like 40,000 people playing on Full Tilt, and someone else corrected him to say 1,000 people playing, 39,000 people withdrawing.
Yeah. Yeah. Although that was not the funniest poker-related thing to happen on Twitter this morning.
Now, what did I miss?
ZBT Horton just knocked it out of the park when Phil Ivey's account got hacked by a bunch of Russian hackers. So all of a sudden, like, Phil Ivey was just tweeting all sorts of .ru URLs. And so ZBT Horton took the chance to inaugurate the Ivey passwords hashtag. Shh, I'm actually broke was all lowercase, was one of the fake passwords, I believe. So I felt bad because it was 10 a.m. roughly Eastern, which means that most of the American poker world was asleep. For that bit of comic gold. So I want to give a shout out to ZBT Horton on the podcast for...
He's a good person to follow on Twitter anyway. I mean, he's usually on top of stuff that's going on in the poker world. I think he's got some good connections. So he not only is he funny, but he's, for news about what's going on, he's a real good source.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a big backer, right? He often has a lot of things to say about staking relationships that seem to come from experience, or possibly just he describes as coming from experience. Is that right?
I don't really know, but yeah, I mean, that is consistent with my image of him.
All right.
So this is, we're talking about ZBT Horton.
Yes.
ZBTHORTON on Twitter. A great follow.
Yes. Anyway, I bet the people want some strategy. We should give them some strategy.
I think it'd be interesting to talk about how exactly you use position, to try to get more detailed on things you can do with position, because we and every other source of poker knowledge in the world is constantly saying position, position, position. It's so important to be in position. But truthfully, I mean, most of the it's not that important unless you actually know what to do with it. I guess it's still valuable in that your opponent doesn't have it, and if he knows what to do with it, you're taking that tool away from him. But I think it would behoove us and our listeners to talk a little bit about what are some of the things specifically the position enables you to do. How can you make the most use out of that, the most powerful tool there is in poker?
Yeah, I think that's right. This is the rare occasion where one of Tommy's beautiful little lines, I think, is completely wrong. He likes to say that having position is like drinking water. It's good for you even if you have no idea why. I think that's pretty much totally wrong. I think so. This has come up in the podcast a couple times. The first, when we were talking about playing in loose games, we talked about how magnified the power of position is, first when your opponents are weaker and will give you more information from their betting for that reason, and second when you can count on the pots being multi-way, so there being that much more information that will
right, you've got position on that many people, and they're being more honest.
Yeah, the river of information that you are standing downstream in is wider. How about that?
Yeah, very poetic, Nate.
I've been reading the pre-Socratic philosophers today. There are a lot of aquatic metaphors, so you'll have to excuse me.
Yeah, so, I mean, position just lets you do everything better. And maybe we can start by picking one example of value betting and talking about how position lets you value bet better.
Great.
So on our previous episode, I told a quick little story about a guy who had King 10 on the turn. The board was King Jack 10 X, and then there was a 9 that came on the river, and his opponent had bet the turn and then checked to him on the river. And this guy, I overheard him talking with someone else at the table about whether he should value bet that spot on the river. And I'm inclined to say that yes, he should against most people. It's not that likely. Based on the preflop action, it wasn't very likely that his opponent had a set on that board. You know, most of those hands are getting 3-bet, and so King Jack is really the only thing I think you'd have to worry about being behind, unless your opponent is very tricky. He's probably not jacking a queen on the river, which is the basis for this guy saying, hey, maybe I should value bet this. So it's one of those cases where you've got this information about your opponent's hand because of your position. You know that he checked the river. That enables you to more or less exclude queens from his range. And at that point, if you're also excluding the sets from his range, then you've got the second nuts relative to what he could have.
And King Jack could fold. I mean, you're not counting on it. You wouldn't bet if you thought that all hands better would fold, but he can see the board as well as you can. And if you think that you're almost a lock to have the better hand and there's this issue about King Jack, then it's even a nice little treat you get from betting that King, you could fold out the one hand that he could likely have that could beat you. So hooray for that.
Yeah, so you can see if you just flip the positions here, if you've got King 10 at a position on a King Jack 10 9 board, I would most likely say, I mean, this is a lot more situational, but probably the right play is going to be to check. And this is because it's not so easy to exclude a queen from your opponent's range. Whether you bet the turn or whether he bet the turn, there's a lot more queens that could be in his range because you haven't yet seen him check the river. And once you do see him check the river, it's going to be too late, right? He has position, so the betting is done at that point. And just being in position there enables you to get a lot of information about what your opponent does not have. And then you can use that information to make a good value bet and to squeeze some additional value out of the hand. I mean, it may not be a ton because we don't know how wide he's going to be calling, but in this particular case the guy was pretty loose, and I think a bet of like a quarter of the pot or something like most likely would have been called by whatever pair this guy had.
Yeah.
So, but in order to take advantage of that, you have to be actually thinking about your opponent's range. You know, you have to be thinking about what does it mean that he checked the river. If you're just going to look at the board, which is kind of the way this guy's interlocutor was suggesting he should do, if you're just going to look at the board and say, whoops, scary board, queen makes a straight, better check, you know, you're not really using the power of your position. I guess you're still taking advantage of the free showdown, but you're not taking advantage of the opportunity that your opponent has given you to make a good value bet because you aren't thinking about what it means that he checked the river. So if you're going to have position, you know, take advantage of it. Think about what is the meaning of the action that you've seen your opponent take.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we're talking about how to use position to your advantage, but something that you just said indicated that it sort of goes the other way too, which is that if you're not constantly thinking about position, you must be doing everything else wrong if you or at least a lot of other things. Or,
yeah, it kind of becomes obvious why you need position if you're doing everything else right.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I said that in a very critical way, but this is something I notice about myself when I'm playing too late at night or too tired, or, you know, I'm just sloppy. I'm eating a sandwich and I'm focused on that, is that I'll take an action and then I'll realize that on that very street, I got some important piece of information that I wasn't planning for and that I was too sloppy to account for, you know, so I wasn't really playing good positional poker. I was just playing, hey, I bet I can make some money if I play a little bit tighter than my opponents while I eat a sandwich, which is, you know, it's a perfectly profitable game, but not the one that I go to the casino to play, you know.
Is eating a sandwich really such a mentally taxing task for you?
You know, it takes some of my attention. And I'm also...
I'm just imagining you being, like, so focused on getting this sandwich into your mouth that you can't concentrate on anything else. You're like, sandwich.
Yeah, well, I'm very nervous about germs and in general. So in card rooms, this is amplified. So I always keep one hand very clean for eating, and then I play poker with the other hand, right? So I have to look at my cards in such a way that nobody else can see them, but only looking at them with one hand. I then, like, cap it with one hand, and I get very nervous when I have to take my hand off my cards for even a second to get something to cap them with. So that's probably more insight into my nitty little brain than anybody needs, but that's part of why it takes such focus. All the more reason not to eat at the table, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I think for my part, like, if we want to talk to people about not just why position is good, but how you can use position, I think draws are probably the best thing to talk about. Because, I mean, you can take this kind of very simplistic view of a draw, which is you can either try to win the pot without a showdown, or you can try to win the pot with a showdown, roughly. And that's way too simplistic, of course, but you can think about it like that. And so you have all these paths available to you. Maybe you want to keep the pot small. Maybe you want to try to win a big pot, like inflate it a bit now, then try to win a big one later. Maybe you just want to try to blow everybody out of the pot. Maybe you think the people might call once, then fold later. You have all these eventualities and all these plans you can make. And I mean, this is why we talk about playing these hands from position and not from out of position, is that, and again, this is a bit of self-criticism, because I think I'm pretty good at following the preflop guidelines and less good at very strictly using the position that I get. You know, it can be very easy to just auto-raise when you make a flush draw, or auto-call with a gut shot in when you think you have the implied odds. But if you're really using your position, you should be asking yourself every single time, you know, can I win this pot with a raise? And if so, would that be better than a call? I can probably win this pot with a raise, but is there a chance I can win a 400 big blind pot later if I keep this extra guy in? What do you think of that? Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I do. And I think maybe the more interesting case is when you have not just a pure draw, but you have like a pair plus draw or something. Because I would say for me, if my draw doesn't have any showdown value, I'm almost always playing it aggressively. Like it's pretty rare that I'm going to take a free card holding a good draw, like an eight out plus draw. I mean, I'd have to be, if like someone has checked me on the turn and I just have six high and an open-ended straight draw, I would have to be pretty damn sure that he's not folding the turn before I fire with it. I'm really not an advocate of playing bare draws passively when there's a likelihood of you're winning the pot without a showdown.
Yeah.
So for me, it's more, you know, the more interesting case is if you have like a pair plus a flush draw, like a hand like that is so, I mean, there's plenty of circumstances where plenty of exceptions to the rule about always playing bare draws aggressively. But I think there's way more close cases when you have a hand like a pair plus flush draw, or even an ace high flush draw, when you've got a draw, but you also have some showdown value and you have to determine, you know, should I try to take that showdown value? How likely is my hand to be good? What are my implied odds like if I see the next card versus if I just bet and take the pot now? Obviously, especially if it's an ace high flush draw, it's going to be a pretty vulnerable hand to hands that are behind you right now, because, you know, and pretty much anything could just pair your opponent or maybe get you bluffed out on the river depending on what happens. So there's just a lot more judgment calls. And one thing that I see people do a lot when they have position, which I think is a big mistake, is just kind of auto fast playing like a pair plus draw hand where they know, and usually their logic is like, well, how bad can my equity be? I've got middle pair plus a flush draw. So like, I can profitably get all the money in.
This is funny. Are you like reading my mind right now? Like, is it actually you talking and not me? You're saying exactly the things that are inside my head. Anyway, go on.
people are, and that's true, but I don't think it necessarily behooves you to like shovel all your money into the pot every time it's like not unprofitable to do that. Like, just because you can profitably get all in doesn't mean it's the most profitable thing you can do. So if you're thinking, well, I'm always going to be like a coin flip with this hand, so I might as well just get the money in. Yeah, I think you're failing to use the power of your position. If I'm at a position, I'm all in favor of getting all in on a coin flip. Same thing preflop. Like if I think I'm in, you know, an ace king suited versus pocket twos sort of scenario where it's going to be pretty close to a coin flip preflop, and for whatever reason I feel like it's on me, I can choose, do I want to get the money in preflop or do I want to take a flop? I'm a lot more likely to get the money in preflop if I'm at a position, or if I have a draw that I think is going to be a coin flip against my opponent's range, I'm a lot more likely to just put the money in if I'm at a position, because continuing to play is going to be negative EV for me. My opponent is going to make better decisions than I am by virtue of his position. So a coin flip is better than getting outplayed later. But just the opposite is true when you have position. You know, if I'm like betting middle pair in a flush draw and I get check raised and I'm thinking to myself, well, I can like three bet and get it in now, or I can just call and try to outplay the guy on a later street, I'm pretty inclined to go the latter route, because if the equities run 50-50, if we just put it in now, then the equities are just going to run out hot and cold and it's not going to matter who has position. But if the equities are 50-50 and I have position, I might be able to use my position to shift things in my favor, to sometimes make my opponent fold the better hand when we get to the river, or to sometimes avoid putting money in the pot when I'm not good and putting money in the pot when I am good, so that I'm not just taking the hot and cold equity. I'm using position and playing poker in order to change the outcome of the hand from what it would be if we just ran the equities hot and cold.
Yeah, I think one thing that you hinted at but didn't make explicit that I want to make explicit is that using position well requires not fearing making mistakes of a certain kind. So when you talked about pair plus draw hands, a lot of people think, well, how bad can it be to get it in? And there's a kind of security that comes with that. Nobody ever got berated. Well, that's not true. But the cool kids on poker forums will not berate you for moving all in with a pair and a draw when you know that's got pretty good equity. And you'll feel pretty good about yourself for semi-bluff raising with the nut flush draw. You know, it can take a lot of discipline and control to say, this guy just check raised me. I could, you know, I have a medium strength made hand. He's too likely to be bluffing to fold. But if he is bluffing, I've probably got him dead. I'm just going to call. Then if I don't get any significant new information, I'm going to call the next street and the street after that. You feel stupid when you coolly, I mean, you can feel stupid when you sort of coolly and calmly make that decision. Then the other guy shows you top set or whatever, and you just put all this money in, just calling like a passive little fish, drawing pretty much dead the whole time. But if you fear that kind of mistake, then you're not going to use your position, because, I mean, that was an example, hypothetically, of you using your position perfectly. You used it by calling and calling and calling, even though you might have been drawing dead the whole time. So at least for me, I mean, maybe this is all excessively personal. I know it's something I struggle with, and judging from the way my opponents play, I think everybody else does it also. So there you go.
Not me. I fucking nail it every time.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm doing this podcast with you, so that I can learn. I mean, you did have a nice example of this in your World Series report from a year and a half ago. Where
did I?
I think so. I mean, you had two threes and you called it off on the flop with against naked ace queen. Of course, he got there.
Oh, no, it was on the turn, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you could have probably just shipped it in. I mean, I think you could have played aggressively at some previous point, but you didn't. You know, you were willing to play poker with a small pair in position. You made a good play. And he did hit the river, but you were willing to sometimes feel really stupid calling a lot of money off with a pair of threes, you know, in 5% equity. So that's, and you have to be willing to do that.
As long as there's a corresponding payoff. Like if it's, if sometimes you're drawing dead, but other times you have your opponent drawing dead, or you get him to keep bluffing with very little equity or something, which I think is what you're talking about.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
Basically, rather than just saying like, well, you know, I'll just put it in on the flop and you know flip the coin, being willing to accept certain kinds of mistakes in as a trade off for your opponent making even worse mistakes.
Yeah, I mean that's the theory side of it. The psychology side of it is just it's not that hard if you're pretty good to play in such a way that nobody's going to make fun of you and that you won't lose any sleep. And it takes discipline and confidence and secure knowledge to make plays that will sometimes leave you feeling a bit sheepish or, you know, make you look silly at the table or make you have to explain something to your backer or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Well, what's the concern about people making fun of you anyway? I mean, the backer thing, okay, I can see that. But in general, I mean, I think a lot of people are, when I hear people talk about like, oh, I didn't want to look dumb at the table or, you know, the other people would think I played the hand badly. Like that's nothing but win for you. I mean, for one thing, you should be playing with people who are worse at poker than you are. So like the fact that you're doing things that look bad to them it may well mean the things you're doing are good. You know, like, yeah. These are not the people you should be trying to imitate. You're trying to play better than they are, not trying to play the same way they are or play in ways that they'll approve of.
Yeah, I mean, and a corollary to that is that you should be worried if they think you play well.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people where I don't really want to be complimented by them. I mean, some people will say it in like a, I don't know what you do, but you do it well sort of way. And like that, okay. But, you know, when it's the kind of thing where like they're not good players and they're like, oh, hey, I'm a good player and I can tell that you are too because you play like me. Like, that's not really something I want to hear.
Yeah, that's scary. That's very bad.
Yeah, so like, you shouldn't be that concerned about what your opponents think because you should be trying to play with people who are less good than you are, less good than you aspire to be. So like your aspiration should not be to get their approval. In fact, it should be to be doing things that to them seem bad, but that, you know, are correct or that will make money against them. I mean, the obvious example of this is like the people in live poker games who complain about us internet kids raising too much.
Right.
They're like, oh, you raise too much. Well, yeah, it looks bad to them and they may feel like you're playing badly, but in fact, those raises are very profitable in those games.
Yeah.
The other reason not to care is that if they think you're a bad player, that is almost certainly going to mean good things for you going forwards in terms of their willingness to keep playing with you and to pay you off.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like if everyone's intimidated about you, then like you're going to break games when they start to get short-handed. People are just going to go home rather than like continue to stick around and or like bump up the stakes because they think you're a fish and they want to take your money. I mean, I'd much rather be thought of as a weak player than a good player.
Yeah, it's I think anybody who's played live has more hilarious stories than he can tell about these things. Everything you just said is completely and obviously true, but you know, humans are social creatures and it can feel bad to be made fun of or abused or berated. I mean, I don't care, but it's hard to really blame somebody too much.
Well, here, listeners, I approve. Okay, I approve. Yeah. Nate approves. You have our approval.
I praise you.
Yes. When you do things that your fishy opponents think are bad, know that you have our approval.
That's right. So go to the card room and then listen to this podcast as you play. And don't worry if people... Yeah, I praise you right now. The hand that you are playing right now while you're listening to this, you're playing it well, and I praise you.
You're smart enough, you're good enough, and doggone it, people like you.
People like you.
Okay, so our guest today is Matt Parvis of Poker News, and I'm sure most of you are going to be most familiar with him from his role in the Lederer Files as the person who interviewed Howard Lederer. So thanks for coming on the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Just to give people a little bit of background, do you want to talk about what your role is at Poker News?
Sure. I've been at Poker News for about 3 years, a little over 3 years now, after... working at Bluff Magazine for about 5 years as the editor-in-chief. I was the editor-in-chief for my first 2 years. In the past year, I've been a little bit more on the operations side, still a very, very heavy creative role in the company, but more so with not just PokerNews.com, but all of our subdomains and our, you know, non-web-based products. So it's a little bit more of a a role that reaches into our marketing strategies and just tying everything that I've done on the editorial front into multiple departments to try to develop a cohesive product that I feel our users can relate to and enjoy over the next few years, and obviously with the, with our current product right now.
So you've got a hand in a lot of pots.
That's very true.
Do you have like a typical day? I mean, could we ask, what does a typical day look like for you, or does that not even exist?
A typical day is, it is difficult to really look at a typical day, but for the most part, I am up in my office here in Las Vegas at about 6 a.m. working with our offices in Europe. Our developers and tech guys are all based in Lithuania. We have a marketing office in Budapest. We have an office in the Isle of Man. And it's just kind of communicating with those guys before the folks here in Vegas get themselves up. And then from there, it's really just kind of keeping an eye on what's happening, not really today, but what's happening 2 months from now. So we're looking at all of the events that we've got planned to cover for live reporting, making sure that we've got teams in place and teams on the ground ready to go. And then, you know, from there, it's a lot of development in terms of evaluating the site on a daily basis and finding ways to improve it and really working on some cool new features always and developing new products. And as I mentioned, you know, keeping tabs on everything that we do on the .com, making sure that all of our editors in our 30 plus subdomains are up to speed in their various locales and countries, and, you know, ensuring that the Poker News quality and what we expect is pushed across all of our various products.
Excellent. So there's a lot I'm curious about with regard to Poker News, but I think maybe we should start with the letter of files stuff, because I'm sure that's what most of our audience is curious about.
I wonder why.
Can you maybe just give us a little background first as to, you know, what happens before the interview? Like, you know, how does Howard Letter approach you, that sort of thing?
As I said, I've been in the industry for quite some time. And I think that although I do work heavily on a, you know, more with an executive team now than the day-to-day content, I think there's a lot of people in the industry, especially players and whatnot, that still associate me with being a big part of what's driven content during my time at Poker News, and then obviously before that at Bluff, where I developed a healthy relationship with a lot of top-level pros. Mm-hmm. And so I think that for the most part, I've developed a relationship in a way that players feel as if there's a mutual trust. You know, I try to always push for coverage that is not necessarily biased or attacking in nature in kind of one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I try to like lay off of the idea of speculation, and that's something that we push very heavily at Poker News. You'll notice sometimes that, you know, we don't always have the same kind of rumor mill stuff that's going on along the lines of some of the other sites, and it's even with the Full Tilt PokerStars acquisition, I think that, you know, people were asking us kind of why we weren't posting some information, and quite frankly, we didn't feel like the information that we were getting and the information that was being circulated was necessarily, I felt it was good information, don't get me wrong. I think that certain outlets have no problems confirming that, but I'm not going to confirm based on another outlet. I'm going to confirm based on sources within.
Right. And you didn't feel like you were able to verify it.
And I didn't feel, exactly. And I think that it's important, you know, poker, in a lot of ways, the industry is a bunch of, you know, young up-and-comers that were really passionate about the game. And a lot of the writers in the industry don't necessarily have, you know, a formal journalistic background. And so we got thrown into a situation where, you know, we were covering poker tournaments and personalities. And then all of a sudden Black Friday hits, and now we're in the midst of a giant news story. Mm. And I think everyone had to kind of reevaluate and almost learn on the fly how as an organization and how as individuals we need to up our game in order to cover this for our audience in a way that's not only informationally accurate, but also is, you know, we're making sure that we're doing everything in a way that we can kind of go back and feel good about and make sure that there's no mistakes being made. And so, you know, when we kind of got some, there was definitely some rumors going around, I'd say the summer, that Howard was interested in talking to a news outlet of some sort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did our homework and we reached out to, through various channels, but, you know, it's hard to really say if any of those actually did anything. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, from day one, we've been reaching out to certain people and trying to get interviews and trying to get as much contact as we could from folks like Howard and Phil Ivey and, you know, the execs over at Full Tilt. And it's, you don't necessarily know, you don't get, they don't send you an email back saying like, hey, no, we're not going to do this. Usually you right. just don't get a response. And so you don't know whether or not you're making any headway. But I finally got a phone call from someone close to Howard, and who is, I could consider a mutual friend. I'm fairly close with this person in the industry. And, you know, they mentioned that Howard was interested in doing an interview with Poker News. And, you know, obviously it was something that we were very interested in. I was, you know, chomping at the bit a little bit at the idea of something like this. And I guess it came up as, you know, as was told to me at least, is that Howard obviously had been keeping an eye on the stories and whatnot and was very actively kind of reading what the industry had to say and felt as if our coverage had been very, very all-encompassing in terms of the story and that we had done a good job of trying to follow the stories as accurately as we possibly could, and we weren't really sidetracked by some of the rumors that had been persisting throughout the 15 months, and you know, wanted to at least have a chat and see if we could go from there. And so I think within a couple hours I was on the phone with Howard for the first time. Mm-hmm. And you know, he started giving me a little bit of a backstory as to you know, some of the stuff that was talked about in the interview. And we went from there, and I was clear that, you know, we hadn't figured out a format yet, right? We had just decided that we did want to pursue this.
That he's going to talk to you in some capacity.
Right. So we didn't know whether it was going to be a video. We didn't know whether it was going to be a podcast or a written interview. But I did, you know, say that I want to make it clear that we're not just trying to, you know, we want to talk about a lot of things here. There's a lot that needs to be answered, and we are not looking at, you know, giving some sort of interview where you're providing me the questions and need approval. And
it's not just a glorified press release.
And I think that, you know, he agreed that that was never, you know, his intention, and that he was looking to. He wanted, as he put it at one point on the phone, is he was willing to accept whatever blame the poker community wanted to place on him. However, he felt as if at that time the poker community didn't have, you know, his side of the story, and felt that it was important for the community to hear at least what he had to say before. You know, passing the final judgment, I suppose, would be, you know, a good word for it, the final judgment for his action. So that's what he wanted. He wanted to get out there the story. I don't think he was, you know, a lot of people said he wants to clear his name. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that he's willing to accept the blame that you know, for his actions or whatever his role in the scandal was. And, you know, that's what we aimed to do with the interview.
So you talked to him before the interview. Did the interview itself live up to the expectations that you created for it? Talking to him beforehand, was it frustrating to you the way he answered certain questions? There was a lot that he seemed unwilling to say, and at times he appeared to get, you know, downright defensive or standoffish in response to questions that seemed to most of us very reasonable and that he clearly should have been expected to be asked. How did you handle that situation? Were you surprised? And as a journalist, how did you try to get him to relax some of those defenses?
Well, the whole thing was difficult from day one, you know. And I'll kind of go back a little bit again to our quick chat on the phone, and then we decided that it was probably beneficial. You know, I said that I was going to need some time to go over the timeline of events and do as much research with the Poker News team as I possibly could. And he felt that it would be beneficial to sit down with him and him kind of give essentially his account of the story without really me asking him any questions. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that would be good too, because I felt it would help me define and have a better idea of potentially areas that he was going to be willing to talk about and areas that I feel that I could kind of maybe press a little harder with, mm-hmm. or feel that we could kind of dig in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I spent some time with Howard, you know, one-on-one in a week and a half or so leading up to the interview. And I got a lot of the story that you guys all saw on video. And, you know, it wasn't a pre-interview. I want to kind of make that very clear, because I wasn't asking questions. It was just two guys talking essentially about a series of events, and I didn't go into any sort of follow-ups or, you know, I didn't bring really my research there so I could kind of pin him on certain things. And we started to develop a rapport, and I thought that that was important. And I thought that that was an important part of creating a level of comfort between the two of us that we were going to, you know, see on the video version. And, you know, that's when we decided that we were going to try to do this, you know, via video, and we started kind of setting it up. And again, this isn't something that I've done. I don't think anyone in poker has done an interview like this. And, you know, I'm never going to claim that I'm an expert or kind of a really good, you know, interrogator. As there's been a lot of criticism that I didn't do a good forensic interview, that I wasn't tough enough. And, you know, I never claimed to go in there and try to do a forensic interview. You know, I'm not trained by the FBI.
And you're not a prosecutor, right?
That's I'm not a prosecutor. Exactly right. I don't have a team of you know, legal assistants and legal aid sitting there like pouring through all of this documentation. It was very difficult. And I mean, between the information I got from Howard, the research out there, a lot of the information about Full Tilt is very vague. So you're having to rely on all these, you know, kind of websites, and it's tough to track the accuracy of these things. And it's tough to read these long indictments and, you know, civil complaints and really nail every bit of it. But, you know, we did our best. I went in there with, I think, an outline that had about like 6,000 or 7,000 words on it. you know, I was clearly worried that the story was going to be a little bit too long, and I was right, in a lot of ways, because it was almost too much. We almost tried to bite off more than we could chew, and I'm not afraid to admit that, but I would rather go in there and feel like, okay, well, we sat down with Howard for like 6 hours than say like, well, crap, why did we only spend 30 minutes with him? You know?
Right, yeah. Because there are only so many opportunities you're going to have to talk to him, or anyone's going to have to talk to him.
Yeah. And so, again, if you kind of, for the folks out there that have read the intro and then the kind of the outro almost, where I kind of go back and look back at the interview myself from a critical standpoint. Sure, there's tons of things that I wish I had done differently. You know, there's tons of things that I wish that I had a little bit more time on. I wish I was a little bit fresher going into it, because I was up probably until like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning the night before, just hammering through notes and trying to, you know, formulate things in a way that I felt like they made sense. But in terms of his defensiveness, I wasn't really sure of what we were going to get. I knew, I had a hint that, you know, just based on the idea that there's still pending potential legal situation with Howard, and that the civil complaint was being amended within a few days, that I didn't think that there was going to be an awful lot of insight into some of the things like payment processing and the segregated accounts. And I mean, I had notes. I mean, as you can kind of go back and see, I ask him about Svetskov. I ask him a few things, and there's very, very little kind of response. But yeah, I mean, the I don't know, which is kind of, you know, that was one of my favorite videos that came out of the whole
thing. Yeah, that was pretty excellent.
That one after there. But again, I'm not sure really what I was thinking at the moment. I think I was so trying to focus on, you know, where things were going to go next, and trying to kind of keep him somewhat, you know, eager to continue as we had been going on for hours and hours and hours, you know, and we stopped the camera probably every like 15 minutes or so, just because the room got really hot, because you have to, you know, stop all the AC in order to.
So it doesn't affect the sound.
So it doesn't affect the sound. So it would get really hot in there. The lights were kind of really hot, and I'm not really used to that. And it was tricky. I mean, it was definitely a tricky interview, and it was left to me a little bit to keep driving a conversation with the I don't knows. Yeah. But I also think that for all the I don't knows, I still think that there was a lot of information that we were able to get from that. I mean, and it's proven by the fact that there's been so many follow-ups, and he was able to go on the 2+2 podcast afterwards, which I think was great. You know, you see the Diamond Flush articles afterwards, which use a lot of the information in there to kind of help either refute or build upon a story. And I think other people are more willing to talk now because of the fact that he did open up the door to certain information that was only privy to a few people at the time. So yeah, I think that we're all disappointed that there wasn't this, you know, outpouring of information or this smoking gun that everyone was waiting for. But at the same time, for all the I don't knows, there was a lot of information that Howard did share, whether or not we want to perceive it as that. There was a lot of information, and I still think it's a very positive step forward in terms of us uncovering what actually happened at Full Tilt Poker.
Yeah, I think you're right about a lot of the poker community kind of having unrealistic expectations for what was going to happen in this interview. I mean, like, there's a lot of people calling for his blood, or, you know, wanted to see him swinging from a post.
Well, the funny thing was after when the first day came out, or the second day, I had gotten, I think it was a text message from Howard, or maybe it was either a text message or a phone call, and he said that he felt bad that I was getting the kind of negative attention that I was getting. And he said, you know, I was fully expecting to get plenty of negative attention from me, but I wasn't quite expecting you to get hit quite like you were. And he goes, I think it's slightly unfair, but he goes, at the same time, you have to realize, unless you had, you know, a baseball bat in the interview next to me, that people were going to be unhappy. And I think in some ways he was right in that situation. And I think we all want to know the truth. And I 100% understand why there's so many angry people out there that wanted, you know, me to be tasing him or something like that. But at the same time, I don't think that really would have accomplished anything. I don't think me sitting there calling him out in a way that was almost inflammatory would have garnered a result that was any different than what we've gotten now. And I think that we've probably gotten more now because of a slightly less accusatory, less intimidating approach than if I had gone the other route.
Yeah, I remember even when the interview was first announced, I mean, but not just people's reactions after seeing the interview, but it was pretty clear on 2+2 forums and elsewhere that that was one of, you know, people's big hopes, that they're already setting themselves up for disappointment in terms of you know, wanted to light the torches, knowing that this interview is coming. And the other big reaction I felt like I was seeing was a lot of people saying, like, you being a very influential figure in the poker world, but not a face that most people had seen before. Sure. Wondering, like, well, who is this Matt Parvis person doing the interview?
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, was there any thought to having like a Christy Arnett or Lynn Gilmartin or someone who is more known to the community as an interviewer doing the interview, or was it kind of always going to be you doing this?
Well, it was definitely considered to look at some other options. I've never really done anything like on air before. It's not to say that before poker that I've been completely, you know, off that sort of radar. I didn't feel like it was my 100% comfort zone, but I also don't think that I was going in there totally scared or uncomfortable. I was comfortable. I think the beginning I was a little bit uncomfortable, and then I kind of felt like we got into a little bit of a groove. Mm-hmm. In terms of utilizing Christy or Sarah or Lynn, I don't necessarily think that it would have been the right choice. I think that our hostesses and producers, those guys work so hard and they're so busy with traveling and these tours that I think it's really hard for people to realize like what sort of schedule these girls work with. I mean, they're in one continent on one day, and then, you know, 3 days later they're covering a poker tournament on another continent. Mm-hmm. And with all that, it was, I think, a little bit difficult to wrap one of them into a project like this for the amount of time that we needed it to be wrapped into in terms of the pre-production and the homework and the kind of pouring through information. And then obviously developing the rapport with Howard. And like I said, I spent a few days here and there speaking with him. And I thought that was probably one of the biggest reasons why we stuck with having me do it. I mean, we did talk internally about maybe bringing someone from the outside into the mix. But, you know, I do have a fairly strong knowledge of the industry. Mm. And, you know, there were plenty of things that I think that have been pointed out by some of the folks that were on the operator side back when Full Tilt started, when I was still on the media side. You know, I did certainly miss some of the insight there that could have been provided, but I don't think that anyone else that we could have brought in would have had that insight either. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my role at Poker News now, I do have a very, very close relationship and understand the operator side as well as the media side and the, you know, from a player standpoint. So it was tricky, and sure, there's reasons for and against and pros and cons, but we kind of went with it, and I can't really say whether it was the right or wrong choice at this point. I feel like it was still the right choice, but again, that's my opinion.
I'm glad you mentioned that you called it an outro, or the blog post that you wrote afterwards. And I'm going to link this in the show notes when I publish this podcast, because I thought that was a great piece, and I didn't feel like it got really the attention that it deserved. Because I felt like you demonstrated a real willingness to be self-reflective about your performance and to acknowledge what you thought were and weren't legitimate criticisms. So first, I just wanted to say I thought you did a really good job on that. And that was really what gave me the idea of wanting to have you on the show, or, you know, that you would be an interesting person to talk to.
Thanks.
The thing that I remember from that, I think you said your biggest regret was that you ended up doing the whole interview in one sitting.
Absolutely.
And you didn't even mention the thing about the air conditioning, but yeah, that's pretty crazy to be in that hotel room for 7 hours with no AC. How do you feel like the interview would have been different if you'd been able to break it out over 2 days?
I think that being able to review that first day would have been really, really important. Just simply because there's things that I spotted, just like everyone spotted, that, you know, there were areas that I wish that I had pressed a little harder on. Mm. You know, when you're in there and it's like the heat of the battle, you know, maybe a super pro interviewer is able to spot these things on the fly a little bit better than I am.
Barbara and Walters would have been on it.
Sure, she would have been fantastic. We reached out. She just had a scheduling problem. That was the only problem. But I think that seeing some of the early responses, seeing, you know, when he mentions that the idea of segregated accounts was really not in the industry's kind of vernacular at that point in time, you know, I would have liked to have gone back and looked at the idea of segregated accounts, you know, in the early stages, whether or not I'd be able to find anything of worth. I don't know. That was interesting, though, seeing that and seeing like how we flowed through different topics. I do think that, one, you know, just from a freshness standpoint, I feel like the beginning we kind of hit fairly well. And then there was like this lull almost when we get to Black Friday. And the beginning, like the first few months after Black Friday, when I even look back and I feel like that was probably my worst worst stretch there, where I felt like it was a very, very difficult stretch where I know for sure that Howard was controlling things more than I wanted to. And I came out of, you know, I went into the kind of the bedroom area of the suite during one point. I talked to a few people and even I could see that they were tired, right? Because we'd all been there so long. And I realized then that, you know, I think Elaine Shavarlis, our editor, said, you know, you need to kind of push a little bit harder in this last segment, just from an area of trying to control the flow. And when I say push, not like push, like with harder questions. I mean, that meant partially, I think, but more so be able to stop him when he was going on and on and on. And that was hard, you know, because he's a very dominating force. Like he's physically, he's a big guy, you know, and he as someone that's been in the industry for a long time, you know, it's hard not to realize that you've got Howard Lederer sitting in front of you there, you know. Yeah. And I think we all started in this industry. You know, anyone that's in the poker industry that says that they weren't at one point like a poker fan, you know, then I don't believe you, you know. And I think that we all were fans. And I think that there was some moments where I'm sitting there and I was trying to be respectful in a way by letting him talk, but not realizing that this is probably not creating the best product. And so I think the last maybe 2 hours, I felt like we did a better job of trying to move things along a little bit more concisely. But I think if I had seen some of that early footage, I think we would have been able to kind of either go back. I think we would have been able to expand upon a few things. I think we could have seen some issues with the flow. And I think that the second day session would have been fresher and we would have had a little bit more energy maybe. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's why really I would have liked that second day and to have split it up. Another thing that I want to point out that was really hard is trying to get your background and trying to get some of the source information leading up to it, but not playing your hand that you're interviewing Howard Lederer was difficult. Because there was always the fear that if too many people found out that we were going to be interviewing Howard Lederer, that Howard Lederer wouldn't sit down in front of that camera with me, right? And so that would have been, in my eyes, a disaster to have been worked all this time on this interview and then have him get cold feet at the end because, you know, he heard we were talking to X amount of people or trying to kind of develop all of these arguments that were going to push our interview in a certain direction. And so I contacted as many industry folks as I could and essentially, you know, discussed the idea that I was working on a big story in regards to Full Tilt and I was looking for some information. One, a lot of people still to this day don't really want to share a lot of information if they do have information. And two, you know, it was hard because I didn't want to directly say, hey, I'm interviewing Howard Lederer. Got any good stuff for me? You know, because again, like you never know if that, how that's going to change the actual scheduled interview. We didn't know until the day until he sat down in that chair and we started rolling those cameras. There was always a chance that he would not do the interview, in my mind.
Like he did for Diamond Flesh.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Sorry, Nate.
No. I was going to ask just to take us through that a little bit more precisely. So the worry was that he wanted to do an interview and he would agree to do the interview, but then if he got wind of how much you were preparing for it.
Let's say that I ask a former Full Tilt pro and they're buddies with Howard or whatever the case may be, or people just start saying, Howard, why are you going to do this? Or his lawyers start saying, Howard, why are you going to do this? You know, there's already just the buzz that it could have created with me asking a bunch of people questions. And I'm not even saying that necessarily had to be like going back to Howard. It could have just been the industry itself getting itself fired up into kind of like a rage about like, oh, we can't wait to get our hands on this thing. You just never know. And I think that you have to take that variable into account. Especially when it's something like this, where again, if we lose it, one, it hurts our credibility a lot. Also, because we've been saying, oh, hey, we're interviewing Howard Lederer, and then we don't interview Howard Lederer, yeah. Right? And that would be a big hit. And two, just the idea of having this interview itself, I felt like it was important for the community as a whole. And, you know, maybe if we were, you know, maybe it lacked a little bit due to the fact that we kept it under wraps and we didn't open, you know, a crowdsourcing thread where we're getting the questions from forum members on the Poker News forums or 2+2 or whatnot. But I think that was a chance that we had to take, was to try to keep it as quiet as possible.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a role for Poker News going forwards? And I thought it was interesting what you were saying about you need to shift your focus after Black Friday to be able to cover different kinds of stories than you'd covered before. Do you see a more like investigative role going forward, or more of a role in trying to prevent scandals like this in the future? Do you see Poker News playing a role like that?
I would like to think so. You know, the poker industry is a weird place, and actually one of the more interesting conversations that I actually had with Howard, which was, I don't know, we were finishing up one of our kind of pre-interview sessions, and we started talking about poker media, actually, and the role of poker media, because I think it had come up. There was a press release that a number of poker media outlets ran about Full Tilt Poker, and I don't have it exactly in front of me, but it was like the day after Black Friday, and it was a release that apparently had run about funds being safe and secure. And you know, it's 100% that they've used the term safe and secure in a press release after Black Friday. But this one particular press release that got floated around, and actually it was used in the amended complaint that discussed the Ponzi scheme by the DOJ, was actually a press release that was made in, I think, September of the year before, when there was some bank accounts seized, and Full Tilt Poker released a statement then. And nobody really knows who the first poker blog to run this was, but it got picked up by so many people without actually checking back that it finally made its way to the DOJ and was using the DOJ amended complaint when it actually wasn't a release that was relevant to the actual story that was being discussed. And, you know, when I mentioned kind of the role of the poker media and the change that occurred due to Black Friday, I think that this is a great example of something that probably doesn't slip through the cracks in a more mainstream news-centric, organization or industry, right? I mean, I looked back to see if we ran it, and we didn't, so I felt pretty good about that. But the fact was is that did happen, and I think that when we started talking about the poker media in general, we talked about how there's very few, you know, established kind of respected voices that have made their way up and that have stayed within the, in the poker world for a long time. And there's the reasons are twofold, or more than twofold, right? If you we were using sports as an example, in order to become like a super credible sports writer, you've got to cover a local team. Right, you're sometimes covering like a minor league team or not even the main pro team for a number of years, and then you make your way up into the pro team. You're covering the beat, and then you maybe kind of catch a break and you get a national column or you become slightly more nationally focused and you get a gig here. But that takes years and years and years. The poker industry is still so immature when it comes to years in service. I mean, like you look at 2003 with Moneymaker, that's, you know, we're not even at the 10-year phase for that or the 10-year mark for that yet. And even though that was a big, big moment, I still think that you're looking at like 2005 before you start seeing like some of the voices that we look at as being respected voices in the poker media. And so, and then from there, just due to the fact that the industry itself isn't really full with cash right now due to the fact of, you know, obviously Black Friday, but even before Black Friday, the UIGEA really affected a lot of sites like Poker News and Bluff and Card Player. You know, it definitely hurt all these budgets. You know, if you want to move up in the world, you know, you're not going to, a lot of these guys, they don't want to stay and be a poker writer and be a poker blogger for a couple $100 here and there. There's just quite frankly not the money to kind of keep a lot of the people that are super quality really flowing. And so they kind of step into either roles with operators or they step into, you know, management roles and or less journalist roles and more kind of, you know, managerial roles. And I think that you can kind of use me as an example, whereas I was someone that was on like primarily the content side of things. And really now, other than just being on a top level, like I have a very, very top level role in terms of where our creative goes and where our voice leads, but I'm not digging into the day-to-day stories really, other than this Howard story and that for the past few years. So I think that that factor alone has put us kind of in a weird spot that we need to continue to grow the industry so that we can grow the industry within the industry of the coverage side of things and pay folks what they deserve to be paid, just because of the fact that, you know, it's sad, but a lot of these poker blogs and poker sites, it's amazing that we're still around due to the fact that UIGEA and Black Friday have hit us all so hard. Mm-hmm. You know, our revenues have all been slashed, and you know, it's not like we're getting Coca-Cola and Pepsi in there to help, you know, subsidize that.
Right.
And so it's something that until we see regulation as an industry, it's going to be hard for sites like Poker News to get you know, as a poker audience, that sort of hard hitting stuff where I can send a writer on like a trip for 4 weeks to interview people around the world. Right. It's just not a feasible expense for any poker media company right now.
Yeah. So one thing you've mentioned a couple times now is first that you're very committed to accurate journalism and good, responsible journalism. And another thing you've said is that most poker media, I mean, with professional restraint, you've basically pointed out how amateurish and sloppy a lot of it is.
Sure.
And just now, again, you mentioned that you have an interesting challenge, namely that you get people who have poker experience and who have enthusiasm, but who do not have a lot of experience writing, you know, good, clean, accurate nonfiction, call it journalism or whatever you want. So you said that you aim to sort of add that to their skills. How does that work? So Jane Doe,
well,
comes
first
to
of all,
you. Yeah.
Sure. Well, first of all, I mean, I think that amateur and sloppy is the wrong word, and I don't think that that's necessarily true.
Okay.
I think that a lot of the guys that come in, I mean, we have a fairly strong set of style and content guidelines that all of our guys follow.
I was talking. I was not talking about Poker News.
Sure. No. I'm going to like paint, and I don't want to say my competitors either, because I know when I was at Bluff, we had the same sort of thing, and I'm sure that all the organizations have a system of trying to kind of cut through the folks that are just, you know, trying to come in and be poker fanboys, and those that are really interested in kind of digging a little bit deeper. But, you know, from our standpoint, what we do is pretty simple. Well, one, we have a strong team of folks that are kind of behind the scenes that you guys don't necessarily see. They're not on the tournaments as much. And, you know, our copy editor is like a journalism professor on the East Coast, and he kind of goes over everything with a fairly fine tooth comb and points out areas where, you know, we're not necessarily following traditional news rules, and then we make a decision whether or not we want to make we want to follow that rule or whether we want to break it. You know, and it's mostly with, when I say breaking rules, it's mostly with terrible poker vernacular, which drives him the most crazy, and just consistency of the way that a lot of people use the terminology. You know, literally things like Texas Hold'em or No Limit Hold'em. I mean, we've developed a style that we really are consistent with that I think that is a hard thing to do. But what we do is we aim to bring in folks. And you know, you can kind of check out our career pages on Poker News, which is almost like always there now, because we're always looking at people that are interested in covering the game. Because if you're interested in covering the game, you're passionate about it. And if you're passionate about something, then you're willing to learn. And so we have a way of kind of going through the trials and tribulations. And it's as simple as, you know, writing a few samples and kind of taking it from there. But in terms of making sure that we're accurate and making sure that we're covering our bases, you know, with every major story, we try to look at it, you know, okay, are we getting this from a source that we find credible? You know, is it a press release from the company? And if it's a press release, then we want to make sure that we're verifying the data. We're looking like we're going back and maybe talking to other industry people that we trust to see if they're kind of getting the same thing. Then we're talking to players, getting their takes on things. And I think that that's an important part of the poker journalistic kind of style right now, is because the players really are the audience. So you want to make sure that you're getting the reactions from the guys that are on the floor. And luckily for us at Poker News, we do have teams at so many events. So we have access to a lot of players, and we have access to a lot of folks in the industry. So we're able to kind of get you know, information to either confirm or to, you know, make us feel like we're on the right track with something. And then we're looking at our audience. And, you know, I think that poker journalism in particular, or poker media in particular, is one thing that we have done is we have been at the forefront of the social media game from its inception. And that was due to necessity. And I think that we've developed a way that we connect with our audience in a very unique way. And I think that we are very, very diligent in making sure that we're really tuned into our readers, and whether it's through Twitter or comments on the articles itself, or our guys kind of being in the forums and keeping their finger on the pulse. I mean, it's just about immersing yourself in the industry, and the guys that are willing to immerse themselves into the industry, I think that they are able to, you know, take it to a level that we can feel we're making progress. Whether or not we will be able to really, like you mentioned, dig deep to do some seriously investigative journalism in the future. I mean, I really hope so. I hope that the industry lends itself to that. And I hope that the people that we're trying to talk to, are willing and eager, because I think that that's a big part of anything like that, is you want to be in an industry where the folks are happy and eager to talk. And right now, you know, that's not really the case with a lot of our bigger superstars in the game, or, you know, other than Negreanu, there's not that many really leading voices out there that are, I mean, speaking for the community. You know, we've tried to sit down with Phil Ivey probably over 25 times, you know, whether it's just a video interview with Sarah just to talk about the tournament, or, you know, I've reached out to him to see if I could get an interview in regards to his thoughts with the Howard Lederer stuff. And, you know, until we start to see a little bit more of an active role played by the participants themselves, that's going to be a hurdle.
Yeah. Andy Block gave a delightful interview last summer where he talked about what it was like to win a bracelet. And then he said that he couldn't really talk about Full Tilt, and here was one reason why. And he probably shouldn't have even given that one reason, and he probably already said too much. It must be a real challenge trying to do that kind of work when pretty much everyone is on lockdown.
Well, that was the thing, is like you brought up my little outro piece, and at the end of it, what I really would have liked to do is, there's so much back and forth on Twitter and on the forums, and people just kind of claiming that they knew the truth. Well, like, let's get everyone in the same room, you know, like, let's, let's do something. If you want to have a debate, let's do it. Like, we're willing and able to put the resources together, you know, to film something like this and moderate it. And I was willing to work with other poker news outlets to make sure that we were doing something together. And I was willing to, you know, put some poker news resources on the line to make something like that happen. And there was just really zero response from anything along those lines.
Well, the last thing I was hoping to ask you, Matt, I certainly hear you in terms of being financially strained to do the kind of investigative journalism we were talking about. And I think even the mainstream media has been complaining a lot about feeling that pinch. And I imagine it's also a pretty difficult thing for you that a lot of the money that you do have coming in is coming from some of those same organizations that you'd ideally be trying to be a watchdog group for. Sure. Do you see any way out of that, or is that just kind of a necessary conflict in the poker media, do you think?
Well, I think that it's a necessary conflict in most media. And I think that it's a little bit more clear in poker. But I think that it's a strange line, right? You know, as long as we have operators like PokerStars and Party Poker who own such a large percentage of the market share, and that utilize inventory on Poker News to try to promote themselves and market, we're going to have a close shave, so to speak, when it comes to, you know, being on the right side of the fence. And we really, really try very hard to cover things in a way that is non-biased towards our marketing partners. And I think that, you know, in some ways we do a good job, but I understand the folks out there that think otherwise. You know, I mean, when you see, you know, an event sponsored by PokerStars, you know, sure, there's going to be, you know, issues at hand with how that's going about. But really, there's really no, in my opinion, way to get around this until we see more firm regulation and we see mainstream advertisers willing to get into the mix. That's something that we've been really trying hard to do at Poker News. If you are reviewing the site from a U.S. IP, you'll notice it's very, very different than the view that you're getting from a non-U.S. IP. And that's simply because, you know, once the event of Black Friday went down, we made a very conscious decision, which some other poker sites did not make, and they're still accepting U.S. players, that we were not going to work with rooms that were accepting U.S. players. And we've stuck by that, and we've probably ended up losing money due to that. But at the same time, we've developed a way now where we're looking at changing the way we do things, and we've created a product that people can kind of trust now, right? And so the folks out there now are feeling like, okay, well, I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm not getting any sort of offers that I, you know, could potentially get me in trouble.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we have a lot of brick and mortar casinos now, and folks that are looking to tap into the poker demographic that I think will be more and more once we see some sort of core regulation. And until we see that, it's going to be a difficult line to maneuver.
Well, we ought to let you go, Matt. But again, we just want to say thanks so much for coming on the show, and best of luck with everything you're doing.
It's fun getting a chance to chat with guys like yourselves.
Thanks again to Matt. He definitely didn't have to come on the show, much less talk so candidly about all those issues.
I didn't even know the name Matt Parvis prior to the Howard Leiter interview, but just, you know, to have some sort of higher up person at Poker News come on, because I would have expected a lot of shilling or just kind of party line talk. But yeah, he seemed really very willing to acknowledge, you know, what were the tensions in terms of where their advertising money was coming from, and you know, just to speak openly about this stuff and to acknowledge like what they were trying to do about it and where there was a problem, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially given that his industry, which you can loosely call a certain kind of traditional media, is in trouble, as he was talking about, not only for all the reasons he cited, but also because there are people who are doing journalism for free or as a part of some other larger product who are not traditional journalists, e.g., asshole podcasters like us, who he's supporting by coming on the show. I'm really grateful to him for that. I do want to say on air that I want to apologize to Matt on air in case there was the appearance that I was putting sort of unprofessional language in his mouth with amateurish and sloppy. It seemed to me to follow pretty straightforwardly from what he said, but I do want to make it clear that those are my beliefs, and I am willing to stand behind that and say that most poker media is amateurish and sloppy.
But I can understand why he needs to be clear that he's not saying that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that too. I just I feel like I put him in a tough spot that he didn't deserve to be in.
And he handled it with class.
Yeah, he really did. Although I do imagine our listeners will understand both why I believe that and why it seemed to follow from some of the things that he had said.
I don't know if Diamond Flesh. I feel like she doesn't do a whole lot of these interviews, and I know Noah's already said he wasn't too interested. But I do think it'd be interesting, maybe people from Poker Fuse then, to talk to one of these, you know, quote, independent poker journalists out there. Because I think that's an interesting, I mean, I really can't see them ever filling the kind of, I mean, neither Poker News nor Poker Fuse will ever be the New York Times or the Washington Post in terms of, you know, investigative journalism. I think the former because of the conflicts of interest, and the latter because of a lack of money. But I do think it's good that both exist. And I think it would be interesting to hear that side of to hear those people's take on the poker media and what role they see themselves playing.
Yeah. I think he was pretty right to say that the conflicts of interest are only more apparent in poker than they are in every other kind of major media.
Well, you know, I mean, I do think I'm not like a journalism expert by any means, but I think almost any newspaper, mainstream newspaper, not just, you know, really big institutions like the Times or the Post, is going to have structural things in place, like conflict of interest policies that, I mean, I guess we didn't explicitly ask him, but I don't get the sense that exists exactly at Poker News. I mean, it seems like there's a good faith effort on the part of Matt and probably some of the other editorial staff as well to walk the line as well as they can. But I think there are probably structural things in place at mainstream news organizations that are most likely not in place at Poker News organizations that probably do make a difference.
That's doubtless right, but I do think that some of the platitudes about capital J journalism are somewhere between empty and myth, and I think he was spot on to acknowledge that. If I sound a little bit distracted, it's because there are policemen and what appear to be military people in camouflage and an enormous FedEx truck pulling into the high school across the street and probably some kind of like disaster surveying. But
yeah, we're in the immediate post-Frankenstorm moments, or NADAs anyway. I'm barely experiencing it here in Pittsburgh, but NADA up in the Boston area is bravely doing this interview from the aftermath of the Frankenstorm.
Yeah, I'm no disaster tourist. I'm just a guy looking out of the window of his study. So big thanks again to Matt for coming on. And
seriously, people need to read this this blog post that I'm going to link if you haven't seen it already. It's definitely if you've watched the. It wouldn't, I guess, make a lot of sense if you haven't watched the letter files, but if you have, I think it's really invaluable to see Matt's afterword on it after he's had a chance to see what people are saying about it and to you know, rewatch it himself with a critical eye. I think he does do a really good job, as this interview suggested he would. He does do a really good job of talking about the strengths and the weaknesses and what he wished had been different.
Well, that's it for this week. If you want to follow not just ZBT Horton, but also Andrew and me on Twitter, he's at Thinking Poker, and I'm at Nate Mavis, NateMeyvis. If you make music or know someone who does, and if you'd like to be featured on the show, please email us at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. That's also where you email us with any other kind of question or comment. Music this week comes from Eric Epstein. He's semi-retired from music now, but still plays the bagpipes, and he was nice enough to share some of his music with the podcast. Until next week, here's a song called Milky Fakes.